Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a brand new episode of The Financial Confessions. It is I, your host, Chelsea Fagan, founder and CEO of The Financial Diet and woman who loves to talk about money. And today we are getting back to our roots and having a good old-fashioned financial educator on the podcast. Now, that is technically true of my guest, although it somewhat undersells all of the things that he has done in the space of financial education and education around the psychology of money and the way it moves around our lives. Because quite frankly, when we were digging into his resume, it was pretty shocking to see just how early and on the forefront he's been about some of the issues that we talk about all the time on this podcast and approaching them in a pretty interesting and fun way. But we'll talk about that momentarily. And thanks to ZocDoc for supporting the Financial Confessions. ZocDoc is the only free app that lets you find and book doctors who are patient reviewed, take your insurance, are available when you need them, and treat almost every condition under the sun. Go to ZocDoc.com/TFC and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. This episode is sponsored by Quince. Shop high-quality luxury items without luxury prices. Go to quince.com/TFC to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. My guest today is Adam Carroll. You might know him from his viral TikTok about playing Monopoly with his children with actual money, the documentary he produced on student loans, his books, or the literally dozens, if not hundreds, of podcast episodes he's done all around the topic of money and personal finance. So without further ado, let's say hi to Adam. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Chelsea. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. I love your background. What's going on? Is that a green screen?
It is a green screen. This was a byproduct of my 2020 days when all of my speaking gigs pretty much got wiped off the face of my calendar. And I was like, I'm going to have to pivot and do a whole bunch of stuff in my basement. So we have this cool studio and a green screen. And now my life is spent on Zoom and doing online programming.
I love it. I was going to say that is an extremely crisp Zoom background, if it is.
It's all about the lighting, you know?
So as I mentioned in our intro, you had a viral TED Talk that I think was like 6 or 7 years ago now. Is that right?
Yeah. It would have been done in, gosh, it was almost 8. Now it's 2016 is when I delivered it.
Can you tell me just a little bit about what that that TED Talk was about and why you think it resonated as much as it did?
Yeah, the talk itself, the title of it was When Money Isn't Real, the $10,000 Experiment. And candidly, it was my second TEDx event. So my very first one was done at University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And it was a great trial run. I thought the content was awesome. And then I came home and was like, well, the video's not great. The audio wasn't great. Probably won't really spread virally at all. And then lo and behold, about 4 weeks later, I got an offer to come to London and do one at the London Business School. And so this talk was something that had been sort of ruminating in my mind about a topic that was of interest to me. And that was the abstraction of money. The fact that money today is less and less real or tangible and more digital. We're using Venmo and PayPal and Zelle and Apple Pay and Google Pay. And when we do that, the money not being real changes the way we interact with it. And so my talk was really about how can I prove this by using my children as examples. And specifically, we played a game of Monopoly with real cash. It was a $10,000 cash game of Monopoly. And it totally changed the way they played the game.
So someone ended up taking home $10,000.
They wish. We set it up as an experiment where the winner would get, I think it was $40 to the winner, $20 to second place, $10 to third place. But it was really about, you know, experiencing the handling of real money. And did that change or would that change my children's playing of the game, rolling of the dice, buying properties, et cetera, et cetera. Because when it was fake money, it was very much just about rolling the dice and moving pieces. And it felt very similar to what I was experiencing on college campuses, which was college students would, you know, swipe a card or use a fingerprint to get into the dining center or buy a sweatshirt at the bookstore. But they knew they wouldn't have to pay for it for another 3 or 4 or 5 years. So it just didn't feel real. And I was trying to use that idea, that example with the board game, and it turned out to be fruitful.
Well, I have to say this appeals to me greatly as someone who does love to gamble. Now, I very much regulate myself around it. I don't go very often to casinos. And when I do, I take out a specific amount of cash in the beginning, and I don't take any cards. And when it's gone, it's gone. But I notably love playing Texas Hold'em. It's my favorite game to play. And I refuse to play it if we're not betting. Even if we're betting $10, $20, pretty low buy-ins, I find that the gameplay changes drastically.
So interesting. And what is it for you, or what started that for you, that idea that you liked to gamble or liked to play Texas Hold'em?
Well, so I sort of consider myself a bit of a hedonist in the sense that I really like just like fun, adventurous, adrenaline boosting things. I love roller coasters. I love, you know, anything. I mean, I live in New York City. I love that kind of stuff. But my parents hosted, they both play poker and they also play darts and a few other games that often are bet on. And they would have parties. They're very reasonable. You know, they don't play with the house money, so to speak. And so it's always been very much just like a fun thing for them. But we always had Texas Hold'em parties at our house growing up. And I would like, as a little kid, I started to learn a little bit about how to play. And I also find that, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. My husband's a huge board game nerd. And there are definitely board games that have a similar level of, you know, deception and psychology involved. But I do think that Texas Hold'em is a very distilled psychological experiment that is, to me anyway, very, very compelling.
Interesting. Interesting. And do you use the prototypical statement like, hey, you want to make this interesting when we start to bet on games like that, whether it's darts or pool or whatever?
You know, it's funny. I don't think I've ever said that. However, as I said, I just simply don't play if there's not money involved. I don't play darts because I'm not any good at it. But I assume based on the nature of your work that you're probably fairly averse to gambling.
You know, what's funny is I love the idea of playing blackjack. And it was the movie 21, which was based on a book, called Bringing Down the House.
Yes, I remember.
It was all about counting cards. And for a while, I thought I had gotten pretty gifted at counting cards. And so I went to Vegas with a couple of cousins of mine and had marvelous luck on the tables. And I call it luck because I thought I was counting cards and I'm sure I wasn't. But I thought for a moment that I could have been in that movie. And it, you know, I left money ahead and I don't think I've gone back and played blackjack since. So not averse to it. I enjoy it, but it's not something I would, you know, naturally go do.
It's not the most fun game to me because there's not so much, there's not as much room for skill quite a bit. Also, funny note that when I was talking about my appreciation for adrenaline, I didn't realize I'm drinking an enormous sugar-free Red Bull for those watching on YouTube and I probably wondered. I never drink stuff like this, but it's been a long day. But anyway, to get back to the experiment that you conducted with your kids, can you tell us a little bit about like what was the sort of biggest takeaway from you for you in the way that they played?
Yeah, there are so many, and they were actually individualized with each of the kids, because when we play Monopoly as a family, which we did all the time, my daughter was always the car. She's not very strategic. She would just, you know, want to go around the spaces. And if she got a chance or a community chess card, she was thrilled. So we called her strategy the luck strategy, because that's pretty much what she played by. My middle son typically was the dog, and he would buy all the railroads, all the utilities, and create a monopoly there. And then he would try and buy Boardwalk and Park Place. It's a very like stereotypical way of playing the game. And then my youngest son, he would buy everything that he landed on with no exception, whether he had money in front of him or not. And we would say from the time he was 5 or 6 years old, Davis, you have no money. You can't buy it. And he'd say, don't care, buying anyway. And he would figure it out. He'd mortgage, or we'd figure out a way for him to buy this property. And so I think the biggest takeaways were each of them had a different personality in the way they played when they were playing with real cash. So my daughter actually appreciated the fact that her brothers were making cash flow and she wanted to play that game. My middle son didn't buy Boardwalk and Park Place, but instead bought Oriental and Baltic Avenue, which are right after you pass go. And at one point I said, Nolan, why did you buy those particular spaces? And he goes, Dad, they're just more affordable properties. And at that point, I cried a solitary tear of pride. And then my youngest son, instead of buying everything that he landed on, he would count ahead how many spaces his mom or I or his siblings owned. And then he would ask, how much is rent on that? How much is rent on that? How much is rent on that? And he would recount his money over and over again to make sure that he could stay in the game. And I think the biggest takeaway, you know, boiling all three together, was that when the kids had cash in their hand, it made all of them far more conservative. And when we did the debrief afterwards, I asked my wife, what did you notice? And she said, I noticed how much more conservative they are with their money than they are with our money. And this is not going to be a surprise to any parent out there, but if our kids believe that we are a constant, steady stream of money and there is no lack, they lose some of the lessons of understanding how to manage it when you're, you know, compressed by a budget, if you will.
I wonder, I mean, obviously, as someone who has this TED Talk, who did this experiment, you're obviously aware that the designer of Monopoly designed it to be sort of an inherently unfair game that spirals toward a winner-take-all as sort of like a parody of capitalism, kind of. Knowing that, is there a reason why you chose that game as opposed to others that are a bit more equitable in the gameplay?
There was no real reason other than the fact my kids would willingly and gleefully sit down at the table for 3 hours and play that game. And, you know, we have tried the game of life, and there's another game out there called the game of success, or it's just called success. And I was trying to engineer it in a way where I could use cash with both of those games. And I kept going back to Monopoly because of the simplicity of the layout, the gameplay, the decisions to be made. So no real reason other than it was one of my kids' favorite games. But I think the takeaways for myself and my wife, and eventually the message that I've shared with thousands of people, was no less important, because it taught a very, very simple tool in how to use money, real cash. And for us, that meant we were going to put money in our kids' hands in the way of allowance, you know, in exchange for chores done. And then the things that they wanted were on them. They weren't on us. And it taught them how to manage money and make decisions in $5 and $10 and $20 and $50 increments, which allowed us to coach them and guide them along the way, so that when they got to college, they weren't making, you know, $5,000 mistakes or $20,000 mistakes with student loans. And so far, my teenage kids have proven that out. They're all super money savvy.
So on that note, so you, as I mentioned, produced a documentary about the student loan crisis, and specifically kind of exploring that relationship that students signing on to loans have. For context, so I don't have a degree. I don't have student loans. That was never kind of a part of my sort of money journey, so to speak. And my parents refused to co-sign on really exorbitant loans, which now I think, looking back, was one of the best things to ever happen to me. But at the time, damn near destroyed my relationship with my parents, I'll tell you that much. But it is, you know, in the almost 10 years we've been doing this work, you know, one thing that has really surprised me is how much you don't really see these norms changing around, you know, 18-year-olds graduating high school and signing on to these loans that not only are debilitating financially for the average person, but also completely decoupled with their real world value on the professional market. And the way it is still not even close to being analyzed as any other financial investment would be, especially one of that scale. So can you talk a little bit about the documentary itself and, you know, where you kind of stand on the student loan crisis generally?
I appreciate this question, because when we were doing the doc, we got a number of different vantage points, if you will, about the cause and the repercussion of student loans. And we had interviewed folks on the college campus. We had interviewed parents. We interviewed students at every level, high school, college, postgraduate. And, you know, by and large, there were a lot of people that were saying, oh, it's the college's fault. You know, the colleges shouldn't be allowed to do this. And the colleges were saying, listen, this is a business that we're trying to attract the best and the brightest. And to do that, we have to have the nicest amenities. We need to have a lazy river. We need to have a climbing wall. We need to, you know, allow the students to swim with the dolphins or whatever they're going to do next. And So there was never really one clear, hey, this is the person responsible or the individual or institution responsible. But I will say this, Chelsea, the United States government holds of the $1.78 trillion in student loans outstanding right now, the U.S. government holds about $1.5 trillion of that. And so, you know, we will point the blame specifically at private lenders. You know, it's private loans that are the problem, but they're really not the lion's share of the loans that are out there. Those are from the U.S. Department of Education. And the U.S. government is really relying on the income that they're receiving in interest expense on those loans, because student loan interest, I have read recently, is the second largest source of income to the federal government. So, you know, without being a conspiracy theorist, someone could draw a corollary to the fact that we're going to make loans really easy and available to young people and keep them stuck in that loop, that doom loop of paying back debt, because we kind of need it to make sure our government is operational. And when I did the documentary and we put it out there, I had one main goal. And my one main goal was that I wanted millions of people to see the doc, and I wanted it to change the way that conversations were had around college financing and really the decision to go to school. I wanted that conversation to change around the kitchen table. And so far, we've received thousands of emails from parents and students who've said, we had a really tough conversation at home. And much like your story, a lot of the students said, I thought my parents were going to pay for all of it, and it turns out they don't have any and they're not going to pay for any of it. And even that for me is a bit of a win, because at least there's clarity and alignment on how we're going to move forward or not move forward.
Well, vis-a-vis the government thing. So, I mean, when you look at America as a developed nation compared to almost literally any other developed nation in the world, we have several massive sectors like this, right? Higher education, healthcare, even things like parental leave, where almost every other nation has, a developed nation anyway, has a wealthy nation, has sorted it out to a large extent, where this is considered sort of a basic amenity, essentially, a benefit of, you know, being a taxpaying citizen. You know, in France, for example, where I did end up doing a little college, because for those who don't know, university in France and even the majority of I don't need to get into the whole system, but basically there's a few different types of higher education, the vast majority of which are free or extremely low cost, including for foreign students, by the way, which is why I went, if you can do the classes in the native language. It's international schools are more expensive. But anyway, so there is, you know, and there are, don't get me wrong, there are increasingly some private schools that are cropping up here and there across Europe and elsewhere. But for the most part, it's sort of looked at as something that everyone has relatively equal access to. Same thing with, you know, again, healthcare, you know, parental leave and whatnot. But in America, we have, despite a just eye-searing amount of wealth and ability to do this, we have these, in my opinion, it seems like the most sort of, the biggest culprit is the just overwhelming lobbies that exist in all of these industries to keep them as for-profit industries. And a government that, let's be clear, on both sides of the aisle, continuously capitulates to these lobbies at the expense of, you know, American citizens, to the point that I think most Americans feel to some extent, and I certainly feel like, for the amount of taxes that we pay, I have no problem paying taxes. I consider that, you know, an honor, quite frankly, as long as they're going to something useful. And when you look at where taxes are going and how little we get for it, especially, again, compared to most developed countries, it is there for me anyway, that I think there can be a real sense of hopelessness, but also a real sense of, well, what should the goal be? And for me, I know what my personal goals would be for the model that I would like to see in place. But having done so much work in this space, what would you say your optimal system would be?
You know, it's funny. We had a conversation with the president of Purdue University, and he was spot on, I thought. And one of the questions I posed to every university president was, why 4 years? Why does a bachelor's degree take 4 years when the majority of what we're taking are either electives or things that, you know, they will say, oh, we're creating well-rounded citizens in a democracy or what have you by some of the classes. And he said he had actually issued a $500,000 challenge within each of the departments to come up with a 2.5 to 3 year bachelor's program. And whoever came up with the most creative program would get the $500,000, you know, for their department to do improvements and whatnot. So, you know, I think the perfect scenario would be changing the way that higher ed functions, where young people can go in, whether they know what they're going to do or they don't know what they're going to do, they can be done with a degree in 2 or 3 years without having to incur the tens of thousands of dollars in student loan debt to do it. So that when they get out, they're actually capable and ready to land a job. It may not be the job, but a job that gets them some experience in an industry they're interested in. And I think the misnomer today, I'd be curious your take on this, Chelsea. I think the misnomer is that I'm going to go get a degree in finance or education or English or, you know, engineering or name your major. And I'm going to go live in that job. I'm going to do that job successfully for the rest of my life. And there are not a lot of colleges telling these students truthfully, you're going to have 6 careers in your lifetime. Not jobs. You'll have 6 different careers. You will change what you're doing that many times if things stay true to form. And so I think we've put a lot of stock in 4 years or 6 years in one particular area of study, only to find that 10 years in, people are like, didn't really want to do that in the first place. I'm curious your take.
Well, we may find our paths diverge somewhat in the sense that as a card-carrying member of the Democratic Socialists of America, I actually believe that the movement toward having many micro careers is actually a massive eroding of labor rights, and that one of the biggest issues in America is the rollbacks that we've seen in labor power and the fact that a non-college educated single earner home could reasonably support a middle class lifestyle with children on one job for their entire career, because people statistically did used to stay in these careers much longer. I think that was a much better paradigm. And I think that the amount of ground that has been lost for all of labor, and by the way, I think this manifests in every aspect of labor, right? Like the fact that we have degree inflation where entry-level jobs require master's degrees when they didn't even require a degree to begin with beforehand. The fact that wages have been stagnant since the late 1970s, the fact that very few people are union members, the fact that pensions have gone away and employers are no longer responsible for caring for employees in retirement, the fact that, you know, almost all healthcare is privatized. I think all of these are huge, huge steps backward in the power that the middle class has. And I think I totally agree that the paradigm of college as we see it now is, you know, an outdated one, or honestly should never have existed, period, because we've basically turned it into a 4-year amusement park for which, you know, the degree is almost the least important part in terms of its market value. But I also think that the bigger issue is that we've created a situation where, because of how weak labor is now and how few jobs allow people to build a sustainable and dignified life, until those things are handled to some degree, I think we're going to be stuck on a hamster wheel for a very, very long time.
You and my grandfather would have gotten along marvelously. He ran for the governor of the state of Iowa in 1973, and his campaign platform was to legalize marijuana, prostitution, and gambling. And he wanted to tax all of those really heavily and use that to fund all sorts of social service programs. And sadly, he did not win in the primaries. But he went on to serve in the Senate and the House, and he started the first employee assistance program in the country, which is now called Employee and Family Resources of Iowa. But it was the very first EAP program. So what you're saying, I mean, we've had this conversation around the dinner table at his house for decades. So I love it.
Yeah. And for the record, I do think that the entire, the other issue, I think, just philosophically, is that for a very long time throughout human history, only a very, very, very small percentage of the population even went to university. It was for a very limited number of professions. And in many cases, it was, you know, limited to the aristocracy. And a lot of the humanities studies were, they were not even viewed through the prism of, you know, obtaining a job afterward. They were viewed as, you know, personal enrichment. And then, of course, you did have other professions like medicine, law, et cetera, that were much more academically oriented. But for the most part, most jobs that people had, the quote unquote education path to them was trade and apprenticeship. So I do think that's another huge part of the problem, is that I can remember, you know, when I graduated high school, that the framing was that the only quote unquote real path to, you know, a dignified job, a stable income, all of these things was through a four-year university, which again, as we can see, is totally decoupled from actual real world job application or higher ability.
Yeah, I would agree with that entirely. In fact, you know, as you're mentioning that, my thoughts went to some of the messaging that I've given to my kids, which is less around, hey, your degree is fine, what you get is what you get, but your ability to thrive in life is based on your ability to create value for other people. And, you know, I look at what you've done, and you've built a thing of value. You have people coming to you, listening to you. It creates a platform for people like me to come in and talk about what I'm doing. There's value in that. And I think what's missing for a lot of students is they are hinging, you know, what they get in school with what they're going to go do to make a living. And this even goes back further than just education and maybe even money. But the idea of like, can we train people or teach people to have somewhat of an entrepreneurial bent as well, where they realize, I don't need to go have a slip of paper to actually go make a really solid living. And I know it's a tall order, because there's a lot of people not wired for that. But I've tried to raise my kids in an environment where I said, listen, you're going to take risks in life. My goal for you is to take calculated risks. Don't be risky, but take calculated risks. Go create value. And, you know, from a financial perspective, we want to make sure that you can stand on your own two feet doing it.
Well, thank you, first of all, for the value creation thing. That being said, I mean, like, my mom's a public school teacher, right? Hard to think of a job that's more valuable to society, and hard to think of a job that's pays more unlivable wages in most states.
My daughter she pursued an education degree, English education, no less. She was going to be a seventh grade English teacher, and she's just finishing her third year at university, but will be done this year. And recently she said, with everything going on, I am changing. I'm not, I don't really have an interest to be in the classroom. And she loves higher ed. She'll probably go and pursue a master's degree in higher ed. But I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, my life has been changed by teachers throughout the, you know, my entirety of elementary school, middle school, junior high school, and college.
Have you ever been looking for a new doctor and asking around to basically everyone you know if they have any recommendations? Because that has been me many, many times. And I feel like every time I ask people, it's like pretty rare that people have an actual good recommendation. And when they do, it's often not even in my network. But on the rare occasion someone has a doctor they really like, it's nearly impossible to make an appointment with them. Here in New York City, this is actually pretty common. It can be hard to get an appointment with a doctor for literal months, which is not great if you have an actual medical emergency. And let's not even get into finding someone that meets all your needs and also takes your insurance. Like I said, that is like finding a unicorn. So enter ZocDoc. ZocDoc is a free app where you can find amazing doctors and book appointments online. We're talking about booking appointments with thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed doctors and specialists. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat almost any condition you're searching for. The average wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 48 hours. That's it. You can even find same-day appointments. Once you find the doctor you want, you can book them immediately with just a few app taps. No more waiting on hold for an hour to be connected to the right department. As someone who has personally been using ZocDoc for literally a decade plus, like I've been using it for as long as I can remember, I used it to find and then to book appointments with dermatologist, dentist, therapist, general practitioner, like basically every single kind of doctor I use. It's genuinely an incredibly useful app. So go to ZocDoc.com/TFC and download the ZocDoc app for free. They find and...
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Book a top-rated doctor today. Many are available within 24 hours. That's ZocDoc.com/TFC. ZocDoc.com/TFC. So anyone who watches or listens to this show knows how important it is for me to shop for higher quality, more investment pieces for my wardrobe. But that being the financial diet, we are always on the lookout for budget-friendly stuff. Because I personally do not love the idea of overspending on my wardrobe. I discovered Quince earlier this year, and I have bought many items from it that I truly love and have also recommended it to so many women in my life who are looking for higher quality things that can fit into almost any wardrobe, can be worn in many different occasions, at the office, out for a date, out with friends, have a sort of classic, effortless, timeless feel about them, but again, aren't going to break the bank. As most of you know, I tend to think of every purchase that I make in terms of cost per use, and in the case of clothes, that becomes cost per wear. And given both how wonderfully the Quince pieces fit into my wardrobe and the fact that they weren't that expensive to begin with compared to the quality, those items have some of the best cost per wear in my entire wardrobe. And I truly believe you're better off buying something good quality that can be worn over and over than something less expensive that may not wash well, will fall apart quickly, or will have to be replaced every season due to quality. Luckily with Quince, you really get the best of both worlds. All of Quince's prices are 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They partner directly with top factories to cut out the cost of the middleman and pass the savings on to you. Quince creates timeless classics that can be worn season after season. You'll truly have them in your closet forever. That includes all the capsule wardrobe must-haves, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters from $50 or washable silk tops and dresses. And trust me, as someone who has higher quality fabric items from many different retailers, including much more expensive places, the quality of Quince, the way it falls on the body, the way it looks, the way it fits into my wardrobe is genuinely quite good, even compared to much more expensive brands. It's a brand I truly endorse and buy in my own life. Get affordable luxury with Quince. Go to quince.com/TFC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/TFC and get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/TFC.
So in terms of, you know, changing young people's relationship to money and getting it to feel more real, I think another really pertinent example is retirement, right? Like it's most people can't even conceive of themselves as being in a position to retire and have a real, it's, you know, and we, I think we all know at this point, if, you know, you're really familiar with personal finance, how much of solid financial habits are sort of opposite of, you know, human instinct and psychology. And one of those things is the real difficulty we have in projecting a future self and imagining that person and having them feel as real as our current selves. Do you have methods that you recommend for, especially if you never had that instilled in you, creating a framework around your decision making, especially financially, that is holistically includes your future self?
Yeah, this is a great question. There is a book, it's called Become or Be Your Future Self Now And it's written by Dr. Benjamin Hardy. And he says that humans are one of the few species that has prospection, the ability to see ourselves at a future state and then make decisions that allow us to affect that vision. And when I read that book, I was in the middle of writing my last book, which is called The Build a Bigger Life Manifesto, which is all about how do you build a bigger life, not a bigger lifestyle. And the idea that we're all life architects, we get to architect whatever life we want. And what I found in interviews with college students, recent grads, entrepreneurs, you know, folks from every spectrum, what I found was that if I said, what does your life look like in 10 years or 20 years or 50 years? It was really hard for people to give me any kind of a clear, cohesive answer. They would give me generalities, but it wasn't like, oh, I will be doing this or I will have accomplished this. And as I started to not only break down Benjamin Hardy's book, but I was, you know, going back into like Think and Grow Rich, where the main message there is definiteness of purpose. You know, if you have definiteness of purpose of achieving something, then you'll achieve it. And I started to realize that the ability to think long-term, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years out, is central to being able to achieve a comfortable and dignified retirement. And so the work that I'm doing with people today around psychology of money and seeing yourself into the future is it's tied, you know, goes hand in glove. And I'll give you an example. There's a client that I work with, Chelsea, who has this mentality that, well, I'll never have a lot of money, so I might as well spend it now. Because I'll never have a lot of money, so I might as well spend it now. And when I started asking, what does 10 years out look like? You know, the answer was, well, kind of the same. I can't see anything changing. And nothing will change when the mentality is, well, I'll never have a lot, so I might as well spend it to make sure that I'll never have a lot, if that makes sense.
It does, for sure. And I do think there's truth to that. I think also, unfortunately, given what we know about the cycle of poverty and how difficult it can be to escape poverty, I think I understand people's nihilism and I understand their cynicism, even though I don't think, you know, I wouldn't have a personal finance channel if I didn't believe that there was some value in trying to exert more agency over the situation, no matter what the situation is, because to your point, being completely defeatist about it and giving up any hope that it could change or improve is one of the only ways to guarantee that that it won't improve. Being as versed as you are in the student loan crisis, where do you land on student loan forgiveness?
Well, it's really a two-sided coin for me, because on the one hand, man, how awesome would it be to just, with a stroke of a pen, everyone student loans get wiped out and they can go back to living their life. Wouldn't that be great? On the other hand, you know, the fact of the matter is, if we were to wipe off all of the student loans, you know, no more balances owed, the universities might then say, oh, cool. Well, then it won't be a big deal if we just up tuition by $3,000 or $5,000 or $20,000 a year, because this will probably happen again at some point. And my fear is that, you know, if we go to the extreme where it's just, you know, wiped away, stroke of a pen kind of thing, then what we're doing is we're devaluing our currency even more than has been over the past, you know, 10 or 20 or 50 years. And unfortunately, I think we're headed down that kind of path. I mean, what COVID showed was that we could crank up the money presses, and it was necessary at the time, but I'm afraid we're going to be feeling the effect of that medicine for a long time. And I don't know that there's any real way out of it. So I feel the same way about student loans. Like, on the one hand, yes, I want my friends who are still struggling under them to not struggle under them. And on the other hand, I think that if we were to do that, it would cause lots of downstream problems. What I would rather see is a change in the way that the student loan payments are made, and or increasing salaries and wages of people who have those. Because, you know, when company profits are through the roof and people are struggling to make ends meet or have to go into forbearance on student loans, I think it's a signal of a very, very serious problem.
Interestingly, I think there's people out there who would push back on the idea that we should raise salaries with the same argument that it would further devalue our currency.
True.
That being said, so, you know, one thing that I think when I look at the situation that younger generations find themselves in as opposed to older generations, one of the things that, you know, I think is like a really interesting example, because I do think, aside from like the personal relief that it would provide to individuals to have, you know, to not be burdened with student loan repayments, many of which, you know, as you mentioned, are absolutely crippling from a financial perspective. There's also the extreme economic burden of having so many young people who can't meaningfully participate in a lot of economic decisions. And one thing I often think about is the way we've seen the housing market go absolutely insane over the past several years. And notably, there's a real situation you have where many older Americans who are relying on their homes as a huge part of their retirement and have these homes that they bought fairly cheap and have, you know, I mean, the explosion that we've seen in housing value over the past few decades. And I wouldn't even say value. I think that's a misnomer, the pricing essentially. Has created a situation where fewer and fewer people can actually buy those homes that the older Americans need to offload. But also they're completely out of step with people's wages. Like people, even if they wanted to buy the homes at these hugely inflated prices, they would be unable to just because of, you know, the disparity with their income. I personally see a lot of similarities in the upside down world we're in terms of real estate, especially as someone who's bought a home in the past few years. But I'm interested if you have an opinion on whether or not a lot of the problems and therefore some of your, you know, the solutions that you imagine are similar to that problem.
Yeah, I think you hit it head on that people graduating today or that have graduated in the last 5 years or will in the next 5 years, if they have not, you know, A, come from means, B, gotten a full ride scholarship to school, C, had some amount of money squirreled away from high school if they were working in high school, that it'll become increasingly difficult for them to purchase. I think the FHA 3% down programs will always be there and will be popular. But what it creates then is a massive house payment that I'm sure supersedes 40% of most people's income and would make them really hard to underwrite, right? So it's more and more difficult to get into those places. The interesting juxtaposition is I have a lot of friends in their 20s and early 30s right now that are saying, I don't want to own, don't care about it, don't want it, I'd just as soon rent. And I think there was this idea of the American dream being homeownership and, you know, white picket fence and the whole nine yards that today has changed. And I think that there's a lot of certainly millennials, but probably even more Gen Z and Gen Alpha that are really more about access than they are about ownership. And I think we'll see more of the either house hacking type deals where someone is, you know, they've got five roommates in their 4 or 5 bedroom house and they're sharing the cost of it. Or people that will just say, no, I want to rent for a bit. And I think we'll see that change. The downstream effect of that for baby boomers and people who are going to want to sell their McMansions is there may not be as many people out there to buy those. And so I think the next few years will tell a story, no question.
Well, God willing on those McMansions, because they were a blight on society when they were constructed and they do not deserve to remain a hallmark of American urban development, or I guess suburban.
I have one more comment on that, Chelsea, please, if you'll allow me.
Please.
You know, my house when I bought it was $330,000. I live in Des Moines, Iowa. You could get a nice house in Des Moines for that years ago. And my $330,000 home is not really worth $650 or $7 today, right? I mean, the devaluing of the dollar has a part of that to play as well. And I think that's, you know, it's just another indicative nature of what we're going through, where these values keep going up and up and up. And it's like, geez, how on earth is that house worth that much?
Well, it's not.
We find ourselves asking that all the time.
Yeah, it's for sure not. I mean, but to me, what you described there in your anecdote about, you know, people turning to house hacking where they're living, you know, with many people to a home, or they're perpetually renters, you know, don't get me wrong. I think there are some people who genuinely would choose that, right? Like, I do know people who, you know, live a nomadic lifestyle intentionally, or, you know, just prefer to put their money elsewhere. But I do think for a lot of people, the idea to be a renter forever, to never build equity, or in the case that you described, you know, live in a home with many other people, I think for a lot of people, that is a question of not having better alternatives and not having the ability to own property or to build equity or what have you. And for a lot of people, the idea of home ownership is, you know, it's not just about the financial aspect of it. It's also about, you know, I don't know. I mean, for me, I like doing home renovations. Other people like planting gardens. Everyone's got their own thing. But suffice to say, I'm worried about the instances where it's not a question of values or priorities, it's a question of options. And so when you see these like really radically decreasing options among younger generations, like, do you have an economic theory as to why we're seeing that happen so radically?
Well, I have a theory. I don't know if it's an economic one.
Go for it.
I think it has more to do with what you and I do, and that's education. And, you know, certainly there are going to be some that it's really hard to make it in today's day and age. And yet one of the messages that I've given to college students and graduates and young professionals alike is there are two major expenses that we have in life, and they are taxes and the interest expense on debt. And those two typically can make up as much as 50, 60, 70% of what someone makes in a year. And so this notion that we are a nation of debtors, I think is part of the problem, because we've sort of raised kids in this environment where debt is normal, natural, and good. You know, no, it's okay to have a car loan. It's okay to have a credit card. In fact, it's advantageous for your credit score. It's all those kinds of messages. Go to school for 4 years, borrow as much as you need to get that degree. You know, that whole mindset, which was pervasive for a really long time, has now created this environment, I think, or has played a part in creating the environment where we have a lot of people that are struggling under massive debt. And the reason they're struggling under the debt load is they don't necessarily have an income problem, because their debts are underwritten based on their income, but they don't have enough free cash flow. They don't have enough discretionary income to actually make a dent in the debt to get themselves in a viable position to buy a home or, you know, do some of the things that they may want to do. And so, again, very personal thing for me, but my goal is to help people out of debt, because the debt is what's holding many of them back from the life that they truly want. And they think, oh, the life I want debt will help me get it. And I keep holding up a mirror saying, look what you have and look at the debt you have. The debt isn't the solution. We need to reduce the debt so you can then build a bigger life.
So I totally agree that we are a nation of debtors. And I think that's clear to anyone who has even seen television at this point, based in America. But yeah. For me, I kind of view that as a very intentional system that props up, as I mentioned earlier, like, one thing that's indisputable is the extent to which wages have stagnated since the late 1970s. And for me, that, like, I genuinely believe that if we didn't have such quote unquote cheap, although you and I definitely agree it's not really cheap, but such, you know, fluid access to credit and to debt, I mean, people would be in the streets, right? People would be, we'd be getting out the guillotines, hun. And like, and because people truly would not be able to afford even very, very basic amenities in many cases without that access to credit. So in your mind, to what extent it is increasing wages a part of reducing our reliance on debt?
I think that Parkinson's law comes into play too often.
Sorry, what is Parkinson's?
Your expenses will always rise to meet income. Mm. Unless intentionally suppressed. And so I think what happens is we get, and again, this is a very broad brush statement, but if someone were to get a $10,000 a year raise and isn't mindful of the fact that their expenses are going to rise $10,000, you know, as a byproduct of that raise. Cause that's just like, well, we have more money. So let's go get the massage chair. Let's go get the, you know, let's take this vacation or let's do this thing that we haven't done before. It's kind of the very nature of, I think, how we're engineered, how we're designed and how we're marketed to. So do I think it would help? Absolutely. I think increased wages would be a great thing. And I am a huge proponent when I go work with organizations and we talk wellness, and I'm often asked in as a wellness speaker because, you know, people's financial stress makes up a vast majority of their time off of work, their stress levels, their illness, all those things. So I'll come in and I'll say, hey, I would love to talk about, you know, well-being and mental health and things like that. But I definitely want to talk about money, personal finance. And I want to know, what are you guys doing as an organization to help these folks reduce their debt load? Because if we're not doing that as an organization, you can throw as much money at them as you want, but that stress level probably won't go down necessarily.
Mm. What is the difference between building a bigger life versus a bigger lifestyle?
You know, my answer to that is a bigger life for me is, if I could take a step back here, it goes to something I was taught by a software engineer years ago. And this guy I met at a conference, and he was sitting up in the very front row at this conference, and he was buying every single book that the speaker on stage mentioned. He'd go to Amazon, hit one click ship on the book, every single one. So within 3 hours, he bought 30 books. And I started watching him, not watching the person on stage. And I was like, what are you doing? And he said, at one point he said, I sold my first software company for $14 million. And at that point I leaned in and I said, can I buy you lunch? I want to know everything. And so we go to lunch and he said, what do you want to know? And I said, just tell me your theory, your philosophies. And he said, everyone's about money, Adam, right? Everyone wants to make more, have more. He goes, but what is it that money gives you? And I said, I don't know, if I had more, I suppose I would spend time doing the things I wanted to do. And he goes, okay, so what would you spend doing time doing? And I said, oh, things like playing guitar, learning piano, spending time with my family, my friends, my grandparents who were alive at the time. And he goes, there, that exactly, relationships. Because people who have money have time, and people who have time build great relationships. And then he said, relationships lead to the last, what he called a freedom or a legacy, which was service. And so I think that building a bigger life for me means I'm going to make as much as I can to free up my time to build great relationships so that I can be of service to other people. And building a bigger lifestyle looks like I'm driving the nicest car. I live in the nicest house. I eat at the nicest restaurants. I have the sweetest clothes. But I'm in debt up to my eyeballs to afford it all. And that doesn't feel like a very big life for me. In fact, my life feels smaller because I have to keep on that rat race in order to afford it.
When you say make the most money possible, are you speaking like in terms of financial independence?
Yeah, I read The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss years ago. And one of the questions I was left with from the book was, how do I increase the value of my time so much that I could make as much in an hour as some people might make in a month? And in asking that question, it wasn't about largesse and I want to have as much as I can, but it was that idea of, I want time freedom. You know, a lot of people will work 9 to 5, 40 or 50 hours, you know, 40 hours a week, 50 hours a week, 60 hours a week. But they'll spend almost all of it. And then they got to go back and do it again and again and again and again in order to afford their lifestyle. I wanted to get to a point, kind of to your question about financial independence, where I could make enough and begin to eradicate my debt down to the very minimal, where my lifestyle expense was super low, but my life was really big, and just go do things that I love to do every day, like sit and talk to you on Zoom. You know, I don't get paid to do these things, but I would do them all day, every day. And in fact, do 2 or 3 days a week because I love the educational nature of it. And I make money doing my thing when I'm not doing this.
Yes. I too read The 4-Hour Workweek a while ago. Big takeaway was outsourcing labor to, very, very underpaid workers in Bangladesh.
He hammered on that. I mean, it was like when you're getting paid in dollars and paying in rupees and, or, you know, I mean, he did. It was all about sort of exploiting those who weren't making as much.
I will say that, that being said, so yes, I will say to, I suppose his credit, I do think he actually did acknowledge the, you know, overwhelming amount of criticism I think he rightfully got for that. That being said, I will say, like, we are in a situation in America, and I'm sure you probably agree to some extent that outsourcing is one of the biggest problems that we currently have with regards to the labor movement, because, you know, until, you know, as long as it's possible for, you know, profit-seeking entities who are prioritizing their shareholders over their employees, which is sort of the nature of being a publicly traded company, as long as it's possible for them to fire their American teams and hire people who will work for a micro fraction of the wages, they're going to continue doing it. So I definitely think, I agree with you that increasing the value of your own labor to more prioritize the value of your time is a really worthwhile endeavor. I just personally believe that that should not be at the expense of everyone else's value, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I get that. Totally. I mean, I think the game for me in the midst of, you know, after reading that book and trying to increase my value in the marketplace was trying to find really talented people that were around me and wanted to work with me that I could pay livable wages to as well. And you know, I think that I'd be remiss if I didn't say, oh, there's a part of me that wants to be just super loaded. Who doesn't? I talked to a guy this morning. He was talking about 2 8-figure paychecks he's going to get on the next couple of years. And I was like, wow, I felt the jealousy bells go off in my head. And at the same time, I also really like spending time with great people. And I have an amazing team around me who I think make really fair, livable wages. And for us, it's about building something really powerful that helps people in mass, and in our case, get out of debt.
Do you really think you'd want to be ultra rich? I like would not at all want to be ultra rich.
I think it would be fun to, I mean, I've always loved the idea of building scholarship programs and, you know, funding causes that I hold dear and putting programs in place in my grandparents' names and things like that, you know, make the Carroll name, have it have meaning or some legacy to it. So in that sense, yes. But, you know, is it about yachts and Bentleys? No, not for me. I'll probably drive the same, you know, 5-year-old car that I have for forever.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I can't think of anything I'd want to do with a lot of money. But that being said, I think there's also, I think the real issue in what you're talking about is that for most Americans, even the visualization, like what you just described is like, you know, a Gilded Age sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? A Gilded Age philanthropist who, you know, is, I mean, don't get me wrong, they were absolutely living their highest life in terms of their personal spending. But, you know, they were building, I mean, listen, we rarely had better architecture in the US than when, you know, Rockefeller and co were commissioning buildings. Was it great to be alive during the Gilded Age for a non-rich person? I would argue no. But that being said, I think what you're speaking to about the sort of focus on what you're creating in the world has been really lost from the narrative of wealth. You know, I personally believe that we need to be taxing are wealthy quite a bit more than we currently do. But even that aside, the fact that what people often become most notable for with their wealth is ultimately just incredibly materialistic and self-indulgent things, I think speaks to the extent to which materialism has really infected our entire perception of sort of what human existence is even meant to be.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of that. I mean, I think the idea of materialism and certainly the advent of credit cards in the 1970s and 80s, that got us down this path. You know, it was like at one point, I saw it was a documentary of some kind, and it said, you know, in the 1950s, largely most of the families were the same. I mean, they had similar houses and similar cars. And if it was, you know, dad worked, mom stayed home with kids, et cetera, those kinds of stereotypical scenarios were very common. And then when credit cards kind of came on the scene, it was like, that's when keeping up with the Joneses really became a thing. and materialism spiked because, oh, now we have ways of affording the things that we once put on layaway, but now we can have right away and look like we have the money, but actually don't. And I heard another speaker at one point talk about the fact that is what Instagram is. It's showing everyone as if they were rich. And we sort of glorify that mentality. And I think it's much to the chagrin of people who try and do it, but do it on borrowed money.
I would also say that it's at least partially the massive deregulation of the financial system we saw under Reagan and then calcified under Clinton. However, I definitely think when you look at sort of pop culture and, you know, the paradigms that we were working under in the 80s and even in the 90s, that our values were not good as it pertained to consumerism. Well, listen, we obviously have a few points of disagreement, which is always zesty. It keeps it really interesting. I've really appreciated our conversation and I really love hearing your point of view. Is there anything I didn't get? No, I think we covered it all. Where can our audience go to learn more about you and your work?
Yeah, information on me is real easy. Go to Adam Carroll with two R's, two L's .info. AdamCarroll.info.com will take you to a singer-songwriter out of Austin, Texas, also named Adam Carroll. Incredible guy. But I'm sure he's getting quite a few emails sent to me mistakenly at AdamCarroll.com. So AdamCarroll.info is where you want to go.
That's amazing. Well said. We will make sure to include the correct link in the bio. And thank you again for joining us. And thank you all at home for tuning in. I will see you next Monday on an all-new episode of The Financial Confessions. Goodbye.